You guys have a good week? Pretty good? World Cup, anyone? Yeah. What are some countries we're rooting for? I heard Mexico. I heard some USA, perhaps. Anybody else? Colombia? Korea? Anybody? No? All right. Well, good to see everyone. We're entering into ordinary weeks, which comes after Lent and then Easter and Pentecost. And this rhythm that we have during ordinary weeks, for me, is very important and formative. Because we ask the question, what happens when the extraordinary isn't happening, which is most of the time? And then how do we do faith, and how do we live life, and what is God doing in our lives? And so we're going to begin a conversation. The Old Testament lectionary texts are going through Genesis. And so Jason Minix and I, all throughout July, we're having a conversation that we're calling slow formation, colon, a long obedience in the same direction. And so that line is actually a quote from Nietzsche, which Eugene Peterson took 20 years ago and wrote a book, A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And so this premise of the conversation that we're going to have is this, that maybe over the last few decades, we've been proposed a fast food formula of faith that often leads to disappointment. Maybe it goes like this. We have a calling in life where we're trying to figure out what that is. Maybe we've got maybe a bad habit or destructive pattern that we're dealing with and we're trying to mature from. And so the formula goes, find a good church, sit under some good teaching, go to a Bible study, pray really hard, and then in 6 months to a year, you'll figure it out. And then unfortunately what happens is often, most times, in 6 months to a year, nothing happens. And so because we've been sold that formula, we think, oh, then there's something wrong with my church, or there's something wrong with my small group. And then we begin this endless vicious cycle of finding better churches, better small groups, better teachings, and then it doesn't work. And then probably the worst part of this formula is we come to the end of that and we think, oh, there's something wrong with me. And then it leads to shame. And if you read the scriptures, what we want to propose over these few weeks is maybe the factor isn't doing something different or doing something more. It's not the function. And maybe the issue that we need to deal with is just time and allowing for time and what God is doing in our lives to do its work. And so this morning, we're going to begin that, and we're going to be in Genesis 12, and we're going to have a conversation about patience. Cool? Okay, so the opening question is this. I'm not sure if it's a good question or if it's hard to answer, but I'm going to try it. So who thinks they're a patient people on the scale? Okay. Who thinks they're more on the scale of being impatient? Show of hands. Okay. So the question is, what makes a person patient or impatient? What are some factors that you think affect that? All right. Hard question? I don't know. We'll try. So just turn to someone around you and talk through that. What makes a person patient or impatient? Go. Any thoughts? Was that hard to answer? Yeah, kind of hard. Anyone have any? What makes a person patient or impatient? Control? Okay. What do you mean by that? Okay. So when you're impatient, maybe you're feeling like you don't have control, so it's hard. Okay. Okay. If you're patient, you accept that it's not in your power. Good. Very good. Uh-huh. In the back there. Okay, so to be more process-driven than result-driven. Okay, that's good. Anybody else?
When we were talking
Okay. Yeah, that's very good. So it's kind of the culture that you're a part of. Have you heard the Radiolab, where they measure the footsteps, the pace of footsteps in a city, and by the cadence of the city, they can tell you how many libraries, how many museums, the size of the city. It's insane. Yeah. Okay. So I was thinking through this, and I have lots of family in town right now. I have two sisters. A sister lives in Hong Kong. She's visiting. My mom's in town. All of our nieces and nephews. So the other day, I wasn't there. It was my two sisters and my wife, Karen. They went foraging, but what I call 21st century American foraging. So they were out finding food, but PayPal right now has this thing where they're giving away free money. So if you look up on the PayPal app, like Cafe Medici's just giving away $5. So you can go and just get a coffee. So they went through their list of things that are on PayPal and just gathered lunch. So they had hit up quite a few stops. I wasn't there. This is what I was told. On one of their last stops, I think they stopped off at an Indian food truck. And so my first sister swiped it. It worked. Karen swiped it. Didn't work. And then my other sister swiped it. Didn't work. They were trying to go back and forth. It took about 10, 15 minutes. They couldn't get it to work. So they go, okay, let's go to the other vendor, and then we'll just come back. The guy was like, no problem. So they go to the other vendor, and then they come back, and then I think they run out of food. Okay? So at this point, my sisters and my wife, they have a conversation. Remember, I was not there. So the conversation wasn't about, oh, this is really trying our patience. The conversation wasn't about, oh, that was kind of frustrating. The whole conversation was about why Gideon would never do this because he doesn't have the patience for it. And I wasn't even there to defend myself. If I was there in my defense, I would have said, I would never do this. I don't have the patience for it. And so in my defense, I was thinking through this, that maybe when it comes to patience, maybe there's a spectrum of patience. I have a chart. And so, keep going, sorry. So in this chart, on one axis, you have the level of importance. And then on the other axis, I don't know where the word went, it's your level of patience, okay? So let's say waiting for a package, right, from Amazon. Not that important. And maybe with those types of things, you're very patient, okay? But maybe you're that same person, go to the next. Maybe when it comes to driving and on the road, you're not patient and you've got lots of road rage. And I think it's possible that there's a spectrum that maybe you could be patient with packages but not be patient on the road. Keep going. Maybe waiting in line. Okay? So I think different people, when it comes to different things, there's different levels of patience. But then let's say things get more important. Next one. Let's say we're applying for a new job, applying for a promotion, applying to a school. It feels a little more important, and it's possible that you're not patient with packages, but maybe patient with applications or vice versa. Go to the next one. Or maybe when it comes to like our life vocation, what is this craft that God has put us on earth to do, right? It feels like we've lived 30, 40 years, and we haven't figured, and it's trying our patience, right? Next one, maybe when it comes to health. Maybe we're patient with vocation, but we've got a health issue. Or a loved one has a health issue. And then maybe we're very impatient. And then just one more example. Maybe when it comes to family, our family. Am I supposed to be single? Am I supposed to be married? Am I supposed to have one kid? Am I supposed to have 12 kids, right? And so I propose then that in this room, when it comes to different things, there's a spectrum of patience. So the question I want to ask this morning then, what does that mean when patience is so foundational to our faith, like so core to our faith? Tertullian says it like this, that patience fortifies faith. It is the pilot of peace, assists charity, establishes humility, waits long for repentance, sets her seal on confession, rules the flesh, preserves the spirit, bridles the tongue, restrains the hand, tramples temptations underfoot, drives away scandals, consoles the poor, teaches the rich moderation, overstrains not the weak, exhausts not the strong, is the delight of the believer. Isn't that beautiful? And what if we became a community that delighted and strived for patience? The Pope says it like this. We are impatient. We're anxious to see the whole picture, but God lets us see things slowly. The church has to learn how to wait. Paul says it like this. He's got this beautiful verse in Colossians, and he's talking about how the first time he heard about this community in Colossae, he couldn't stop praying for them. And he prayed that they'd be filled with knowledge, that their knowledge would bear fruit, and they would do good things. And then he ends this with this, that they would be strengthened with all power. He's like, this is my prayer, that this community in Colossae would have like all strength, according to God's glorious might, that God would strengthen you with all of his might so that you can do more good things, so that you can accomplish more, so that you may know more. What did he say? So that you may have great endurance and patience. James, Jesus' brother, says it like this. He says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming, which is a while, a minute, a couple minutes, right? And then he says, see how the farmer waits for the land to yield valuable crop. Think about a farmer. You've planted your seeds. Adding more water doesn't help. Like intensifying the sun doesn't. Just wait. As a farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and the spring rains. And then Paul says it like this. If you want to know what love is, it's first and foremost patience. And so this is going to set up our conversation for the next few weeks. But I thought, what would it look like? Why does God invite us into patience? Why is he patient? Why would it be helpful for us as a community, as individuals, to learn patience? And so this morning, we're going to be in Genesis 12, and we're going to start with Abram. So this is before Abram becomes Abraham. It'd be like meeting Prince before he's a symbol. It'd be like meeting... who came? Was it Puffy or P. Diddy? Who? What is he now? He went back? Oh, so it didn't apply. All right. Did he go Puffy, P. Diddy, Puffy? Okay. Okay. So we're meeting Abram before he's Abraham. So we'll be in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 5. Go ahead and read it. All right. Let's pick this up in verse 1. So God's having a conversation with Abram. And it says that at this point, he's 75. So I'm guessing that most of us are not yet 75. So if this conversation hasn't happened yet, it's okay. So the Lord says to Abram, go from your country, your people, and all your father's household. So go, leave the place where your family's been for generations. Now pick up and leave. And then go. I'm not telling you where you're going to go, but just go, and then I'll show you. And he says the goal is this, verse 2. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This is what he's saying. So this is what I want. I want everyone who lives to be blessed, like everyone. But you're going to be the source of dispersing all the blessings. So everyone's going to be blessed through you. I'm going to bless you, and then you pass it on. So if you think through this, if God's goal here, so the goal is what? To bless everyone, right? So if his goal is efficiency and excellence, he probably could have done it himself, right? He could have been like, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, we're going to bless the world. How long does that take? 20 minutes? Five? Like, is that right? But his goal, and throughout all of the scriptures, is he's got this relentless pursuit to collaborate with us. And sometimes we wonder why it's so slow, because he's choosing to use people like Abram and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and you and me. If the goal were efficiency, it would be boom. But the goal here is collaboration. There's an NBA team called the Sacramento Kings. So the Sacramento Kings were recently bought by new ownership. There's a new owner. So every year there's a draft. In the draft, they select the best players for whoever's going to be on their team. So this is a multi-million-dollar industry. And then usually they hire statisticians, tacticians, they got the general manager. And so did anyone hear about what the Sacramento Kings did this year for the draft? So instead of just hiring experts, they decided to crowdsource their decision for the draft. So they made an open call and said, you can submit and help us choose the player we're going to draft. Check out the clip.
There's a player, his name's Alfred Payton, who matches up very well with Marcus Smart.
I basically ran a probability model.
So off the point of ball movement,
we could estimate that a 10 Macklemore
touches process ratio.
If you look at the Spurs this year, they had...
I actually like Anderson.
Macklemore's numbers with Thomas on the court.
They kind of rank more highly in my
model. He's a good shooter from outside.
Even if you look at Darren Williams' college stats at Illinois, he's not an athletic freak.
I'm looking forward to what you guys got today because... frankly and candidly, I may be crazy, but I'm actually thinking about trading this pick in what I think is a really good draft.
There's a lot of brilliant people who are NBA fans. We decided to pick fans who are brilliant and bring them to us. And now with all the data that's out there now, the challenge is in processing it. So our crowd that we put together is processing it as a group. And I think as that crowd kind of goes through their process, it's changing the way we feel about some of the picks and our own team, in fact.
So what's interesting here is in his process, he's crowdsourcing, and his criteria is he chooses the most brilliant and the best. And God decides to crowdsource as well, and he decides to collaborate, but his criteria is a little different. Instead of the best and the brightest, it's the most surprising and the most unexpected. And sometimes we're so frustrated with God's time, and it's because he's using us. So if you look at Abraham's timeline, so you've got Abram, and God meets him. And so his first conversation in this covenant, he's 75, okay? If you go to the next slide, nothing really happens. He gets into an argument with his nephew. He faces famine and then just waits for about 25 years. So how old are you being told? I'll be 65 in 25 years. Just think about that. And then he lives another 100. So God's vision here is to bless him so that he can be a blessing, so he'll be a great nation. If you go to the next slide, the scale is probably even longer. So let's say, when does Israel become a great nation? So this is 2018, approximately BC. So some historians can say, okay, so maybe when David takes the reins and then Solomon builds the palace, maybe that's when they become a great nation. So that's about 1,054 years. And then commentators, theologians say most likely he's actually talking about Jesus, and that someday they'll point to Jesus, and this will be in the lineage of blessing everyone through Jesus. So that takes approximately 2,000 years. So let's go to the scale of our lives. So we're, out of college, and we've got a good degree, and we're pretty smart, right? We moved to Austin. There's a lot going on, right? And we figure out this is my craft, right? This is what God's called me to. And then in 2 years, we figure out, oh, that's not my craft. And we think, good God, my life is over, right? What is God doing? And then we hit 40, and we go, we haven't figured out anything. I'm buying a sports car. I'm going to get like a convertible. I'm going to unbutton my shirt a little bit because I haven't done squat, right? And my whole point of this in setting up the conversation is, one, it's okay, and it takes time. And a big part of why this is slow is because God's going to bless our world, our cities, our workplaces, our neighbors, unfortunately, for better or for worse, through us. And God's okay with it, and I think we should be too. Let's pick up the text. So he says, all right, I'm going to bless you. So at this point, he's pretty excited. So this is fantastic. I'm going to have lots of babies, right? Third babies, are going to have lots of babies, and we're just going to be like a blessing machine family. Everyone who comes will be blessed. I'm going to bless the world. Okay, so in verse 4, so they went, which is huge. He takes a step. He trusts God here. And they went as the Lord had told him. And then Lot, his nephew, was like, hey, can I come? He's like, sure. Little did he know, Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. Then he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all of the possessions they had accumulated, the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and then they arrived there. And then in the next couple paragraphs, the two most exciting things is he builds an altar and he worships. I don't know what he's thinking. He's thinking, God, this is so great. You made this. I'm going to worship, right? And then he's thinking, I'm going to build an altar here. I'm going to have at least 12 babies right here at this altar. Then he builds another altar. I'll have another 15, right? And all nations will be blessed through me. And then nothing happens. And his only instruction is that he's going to be blessed to be a blessing. So the only thing he knows is, oh, I'm going to be a blessing. So while nothing is happening, maybe God's giving him room to practice being a blessing. He's probably thinking, oh, wait, I thought you were just going to wave a magic wand and then I'd be good at blessing. And it turns out it takes him 25 years, and it turns out that Abraham's not that good at being a blessing. And so maybe a question for us is, in this calling, what is that craft that maybe God is giving us space to work on? Maybe it's programming. Maybe it's painting. Maybe it's building. Maybe it's woodworking. Maybe it's baking. Maybe it's starting a business. And then how in that craft are we becoming a blessing? I was talking to someone this past week. So I moved here from Detroit in 1999. And there's a guy I talked to this past week that I hadn't spoken to in 15 years. I knew him when I lived in Detroit, and he's now wanting to start a church. So he said, hey, can my leadership team and I meet with you, and we'll have like a Skype conference call? I said, sure. And so I met with these guys. I'd never met them, and they were just asking about my story. Where are you from? I said, I'm from Toronto. How did you get to Detroit? I said, well, I went to seminary in Chicago, and then I moved to Detroit, and I loved Detroit. And then he says, why did you leave Detroit? Why did you go to Austin? I said, well, we didn't really want to leave Detroit because we loved Detroit, but there was this possible invitation to start a church. And then we had said no a few times, and then the last piece of the puzzle was we found out we were pregnant. I had family in town. My parents were in town, and then so we moved. And so they go, oh, so you moved to Austin in 99? I said, yep. And they said, so did the church start in 2000? I was like, nope. Like, did the church start in 2001? I was like, nope. 2002? Nope. 2003? Nope. 2004? Said, when did the church? 2006. So I could see them. I'm Skyping them. They're, like, doing the math. They're like, so you moved, and it took 7 years to start the church. I was like, that sounds about right. And then they go, what were you doing? I said, and I had to think about it. I was like, well, we had a couple babies, and then I was working for the immigrant church. They were gracious enough to give me a job. And then they had this vision, and we were all figuring out how to plant a church. And then they go, was it hard? I said, yeah, it was hard. And then this third guy who I'd never met, he asked me this. No one had ever asked me this. He goes, in those 7 years then, what did you learn? And I paused, and I said, well, I think I learned how to be patient. I think it gave me a lot more humility. I think it just gave me room to learn how to teach better, to pastor better. And then there was just some grace to, like, I had a bit more space to be a dad. And when I was saying this, something came to mind that I had never realized. So in those 7 years, was it frustrating? It was. Who would I blame? I would often blame God. Okay, so the first year we moved from Detroit to Austin, we had started something in Detroit. We came and worked for a somewhat large established church. The first year, every Sunday, we would go home and cry. Karen and I would cry. And we'd go, what are we doing here? We're like, I thought we were going to possibly start a church. We're like a year into this, and nothing would happen. And then I would shake my head. I was like, God, why? Right? Okay, so I blame God. Probably the recipient that I blame the most was the mother church. In my mind, I was like, get your act together, right? You brought me down. We would start the church in a year. It's been 7 years. It took me this week, it took me 15 years to realize, do you know who God was waiting on? Me. God was gracious enough to give me time to learn how to lead, to learn how to be a pastor. God was gracious enough to give me time to be a father. And so in that craft, in this space that we're working on, if your answer is, I don't know, that's a very appropriate answer. And it's okay. And maybe day to day, in that craft of learning how to bless, what does that look like then? Maybe God is collaborating with us in someone he's brought into your life that has more than their daily load to carry. Our care team talks a lot about that. When we have more than our daily load. And maybe we just need to learn how to bless that person in small ways. Maybe it's a musician. And maybe we've got all these instruments and there's this craft and there's this art and there's lyrics that are birthing inside of us, but we're just working the restaurant every day. Maybe it's just space to learn how to submit and to be humble and then to create when we can. Maybe it's programming. Maybe it's starting a business. And whatever it is, if you look at that timeline, we're probably okay. And to ask, what is God doing here and now? And then how can I learn to be a blessing? And it says in verse 4, so Abram went, as the Lord told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old, and then they left. So the next part, the chapter ends, and I like this. I like how the chapter ends, because it's his first chance. So you're going to be the father of all. You're going to be the, everyone's going to learn how to bless the world through you, okay? So I'm going to give you one first try. All right, famine hits. You're going to be a refugee in Egypt. Let's see how Abram blesses people. How does he do? Verse 10. Now there was famine in the land. Abram went down to Egypt, lived there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he devises this plan. He's like, Sarai, I've got this fantastic plan, right, for me. This plan is mainly about me, not much about you, but it's a fantastic plan, right? So he says, so when we get there, I know. So he starts out with a compliment. He softens her up. Honey, you're so beautiful, and I know how beautiful you are, and everybody knows how beautiful you are. You're gorgeous. Honey, I think you're beautiful. And then he says, so when the Egyptians see you, they'll say, this is his wife. And then they'll kill me, but they'll let you live. So that doesn't work out well for me. Right? That's a bad plan for me. It's good for you because you're beautiful. So this is our plan. So say that you're my sister so that I will be treated well for your sake. And my life will be spared because of you. And it turns out that when it comes to blessing, Abraham's not very good at it. And it turns out you have to think about more than yourself when you want to be a blessing. And then so the problem is they get to Egypt and then the plan works. And then he loses his wife, who's now a part of Pharaoh's concubine, but he gets the dowry. So he's sitting there with sheep and servants and cattle. And he's like, oh, I didn't think through this part. Right? Because now I have sheep and cattle and servants, but I don't have a wife. And then in this story, God rescues Sarai. And he imposes a limit and a boundary that frees her. It's a boundary, it's a limit that frees her. So the Egyptians now get this disease. We don't know what disease it is. We don't know what happens. Somehow through that disease, they find out that, oh, you're actually married to Abram. And then Pharaoh sends them, and the story ends. God's not that upset. There's no like, what did you do? They leave with all their stuff and Sarai. So there's a couple observations here that I think are important. I think when it comes to limits and boundaries, often they're freeing things. So we've talked about this from a craft perspective. So artists understand this, right? When you don't have any limits as an artist, it's not freeing, it's debilitating. But when you have limits, if you're a jazz musician, your limits are the scales. Once you hone the scales, those limits, you can dance. If you swing dance, you learn the footsteps, those are your limits, and then you're free to dance. When I tell people how I give sermons, I actually tell them I do the exact same thing every week. I have 3 points, I teach, I tell a story, then I apply. People are like, what? That's crazy. And then I tell them that Mitch Hurwitz, who started Arrested Development, he cut his teeth on Golden Girls. He was one of the writers of Golden Girls. And he says, in a comedic structure in a sitcom, it's the exact same limits. He said the structure and the story arc for Golden Girls and Arrested Development is the exact same thing. Okay, so we understand that from an artistic perspective. I think we understand limits as a freeing thing from a physical perspective, right? My limit is that if I cut my hand, it will hurt and bleed. Okay, if I eliminate that limit and the pain, I'm not free. I have leprosy. Okay, that's what happens. And I think it's helpful for us to understand mistakes we make and sins and limits as healthy limits and boundaries that free us. Okay, first observation. Second observation is this. God is way more patient with Abram than I would have been. God seems like, okay, you're going to be a blessing, and here's some space to practice. Okay, that didn't go well. That didn't go well. What did you learn, right? Let's do it better. If I were to come to Abraham, I'd be like, what did you do? That's your wife. How could, like, that's terrible, right? And I like that in this space and in this craft and what God's calling us to, he gives us time to make mistakes and practice. So I was riding my bike with my older son, Joshua, who's 14 the other day, and he wants to start racing bikes. And so this summer we've been training. And so on Tuesdays, we've been going to Walnut Creek. Have you guys been to the new Walnut Creek Trail that goes up to Manor? And it's about maybe 10 miles out, 10 miles back. And then we did intervals, and then we did some hill repeats, and then we were on our way back. And so he was on his bike, I was on my bike. And then in the middle of the path, because they're still working on it, there's a random stop sign. I think there's construction vehicles that go through. So he's sitting on my wheel, which means he's drafting me and he's really close. I come up to the stop sign and I slow down. He had his head down, we touch wheels and he goes down. I can hear my son, you hear the scrape of metal, and then you hear him go, oh no! And then you hear the bike like crashing. As a father, all parents feel this. When your children hurt, it physically hurts you. Okay? So as a loving father, I could have responded in a couple ways there. So he's bleeding, he's kind of hurt, and he's sitting there. I could have sat down and said, as your loving father, I'd like to eliminate all pain from your life. So my brother-in-law used to be an anesthesiologist. I'll tell him to bring some of his gear. So each time we go on a bike ride, let's give you an epidural. And then, because crashing is just a part of bike racing, so when you crash, you won't feel anything, right? As a loving father, would that be helpful? Probably not, right? As a loving father, I felt his pain, and I just sat there, and I say, oh, man, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? And we just took a moment, and I just kind of gave him, like, patted him. I can't hug him. He's bigger than me. Just patted him on the back. Actually, patted him on the back. Like, are you okay? And then as we were going back, I told him, I said, this is actually a pretty helpful training ride because sometimes we do crash. And now you have to learn you always got to keep your eyes up. And when you crash, you know how to fall. And so all in all, I think it was a good practice day. And I've never read this narrative of Abram and what he does in Egypt. And God says, it's okay. You've got another 25 years to learn how to be a blessing. This one didn't go very well, so let's do better next time. And that we love that God is patient with us. We love that, right? Paul says it like this in this verse. He says, but for that very reason, I was shown mercy so that in me, the worst of sinners, that Christ Jesus might display his immense patience as an example for those who would believe in him and receive eternal life. And so it's beautiful that God is immensely immensely. He's slow to anger. He's abounding in love. His mercies are new every morning, and he's patient. And so the question I leave you with then is, in God's patience with us, are we patient with him? And are we patient with those around us? So the other day, you can tell I've been working from home and there's been lots of kids around because these are all my stories. So there's 12 nieces and nephews, including my boys, and they play tag. So the boys are the older ones, and then there's some younger ones. It spans from age 14 to like 1.5, okay? So the 12-year-old all the way down to the 3-year-old, they were playing tag. And so the 10, 11, 12-year-olds are much faster, and they were just dominating the tag game. They're like, tag, tag. And then the short guys are just running, and they can't catch them, where they got really frustrated, and they started crying, okay? So once someone starts crying, we go home. And then I was talking to the older ones in the car, and I said, hey, listen, when you play tag with them, when the dads play with you, how do we play? They're like, what? You don't take it easy? We're like, okay. Seriously? I was like, do you want us to not take it easy on next time? They're like, so I said to them, however you want to be treated, treat the younger ones. And they go, fine, then we're not playing with them. And we're like, okay, that's fine. You have a choice. You cannot play with them, but then the dads won't play with you next time. Whatever you choose, the dads will respond to you in the same way. And they just sat there. They're like, okay, we'll play with them. And throughout the scriptures, God never asks anything of us that he doesn't offer to us. And as we receive great, immense, vast, generous patience from God, receive it, take it, give thanks for it, and then offer it back to God, and then offer it to the world around us. And I pray that maybe in the summer, in these ordinary weeks, maybe nothing will happen in our community. Maybe nothing will happen in our lives, but we'll be okay. And God is still gracious and generous and working. And so my prayer for us this morning is the prayer that Paul prayed to the church in Colossae. And I pray, Vox, that God will continually fill us with the knowledge of his will, that he'll fill us with all wisdom and understanding that the Spirit gives us. Vox, I pray that we will live lives worthy of God, that will be pleasing to him, that through that we'll bear fruit in every good work. And Vox, may we be strengthened with all power, with his glorious might, so that we may have great endurance and patience. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.